Hello, I'm the ghost of Philip Goff. Welcome to Mind Chat.
No, once a man of thought and noble birth, I'm now a fiend, a wretch, a thing accursed. In search of brains, I roam the haunted earth. In this forsaken state, I am immersed.
Jeez, are you okay?
My quest for sustenance is all I know, to tear through flesh and bone my only heart.
Are you all right, Keith? Do you need a doctor?
With each grisly feast, my hunger grows. A zombie damned to feed on mortal heart.
So Keith, are you having an episode? Do you need some help?
I was trying to act like a zombie for that Halloween special.
Oh, there's, I thought you were having a nervous breakdown. Sorry.
Play Shakespeare. You what?
Anyway, how are you? How are you doing? It's been ages. I've missed you.
Oh, really? Well, miss me?
I say missed you. You know, I just mean haven't seen you for a while.
Well,
you're all right, then. Anyway, what are you supposed to be? You look like an idiot.
I'm supposed to be a zombie, yeah, but a zombie who has dreams and hopes and aspirations, a zombie that feels and loves and cares, but all in a functional sense, you understand, not the phenomenal sense. Yeah.
And
a zombie who wants to play Shakespeare. We zombies have dreams, you know.
Well, I'm glad you're finally embracing your zombie identity. I think you've been in denial about it for a long, long time, claiming that you're conscious, and I'm glad you finally, you know, it's okay. You finally come out of the closet as a zombie. That's really wonderful.
Anyway, what are you supposed to be?
Well, I'm sorry to say some sad news that Philip Goff died last night, I'm afraid, after a very bad case of existential uncertainty, something he's been suffering from for a long time now. But no need to fear. He didn't really like anything physical anyway. So, and his ghost is here, and if anything, more competent, really. So, a bit better with technology. So, yeah.
Oh, well, okay. nice to have you as my spiritual co-host. So, wait, you said we had a big guest to kick off the new series 4. So, who's it going to be?
You are going to be over the moon. I think it's no exaggeration to say that I've got on one of the most important and influential thinkers of modern times, really.
Wow. Well, who is it? I'm excited. Yeah. I mean, we had Noam Chomsky last time to kick off the last
season. You're not going to believe it.
Yes. Who is
it? You're not going to believe it. No? It's me!
Yeah, very good one. But who is it, really?
No, it is. It's me. I've got a new book out, and we're going to talk about it.
Oh,
new book.
Oh,
it'll be good. It'll be great. I thought you'd be pleased.
Yeah, that's great. So, what's this book about? More outlandish claims?
Oh no! Just
come on. What's it about?
Just normal standard philosophy. Just, you know.
Oh, come on! Don't be shy. What are you claiming this time, eh? The moon landings didn't happen. You haven't found Bigfoot, have you?
Oh, it's just normal stuff.
Come on, spit it out.
Arguing that the universe has a purpose.
The what? I couldn't hear that, Philip. A bit louder.
Arguing the universe has a purpose.
Arguing
the universe has a purpose.
You're arguing that the universe has a purpose, huh? Well, you don't do things by halves, Philip. I'll give you that. Arguing that the universe has a purpose.
It sounds silly, but honestly, I feel silly saying, but I've just discovered they're actually pretty good arguments, and that's honestly, there are good arguments.
Well, I'll be the judge of that. Let's we'd better discuss these arguments. But before we do, since you are the guest on this week's Mind Chat, I think you deserve a proper introduction. Okay. So, and I have actually prepared one.
Actually, hold on. Before we get to that, another announcement for our new series. We are finally, we're going to try and get this thing a bit more sophisticated. I know we advertise as the podcast with the lowest production values and the greatest philosophy, but want to try and get things a bit more sophisticated. We've got lots of people who've offered to edit videos and so on. I want to get rid of that bloody duck, wherever it is. So we finally set up a Patreon, which is in the show notes for this. You can pledge the three categories. You can pledge $2 to get nothing. Well, just to, you know, feel good about yourself for keeping this wonderful podcast on the road. $5.
Probably furthering the purpose of the universe as well.
Furthering the purpose. That's what I should have said instead of nothing.
Yeah.
Same thing. $5, you get an exclusive after show episode. So from next month, each episode, we're going to do a little bit at the end. Only to $5 or more Patreon supporters, where we'll discuss what we thought of the guest, what's going on in the world of science and philosophy of consciousness and so on. And then $10, the premium Mind Chat subscription per month. We're going to have a monthly Zoom chat with Keith and myself, talk about whatever science and philosophy of consciousness. We're going to do it rotation to like me 1 month, Keith next month, both of us the next month. So like 3 month rotation. So yeah, we can have some chats. Anyway, I don't know. That's our first attempt at this after advice. Maybe it'll evolve as we go along, but have a look at that if you fancy. I can't see anything through this. Anyway, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here. Excellent. So yes, please, okay. All right. All take a look at that. Now let me do your introduction.
So can I go off and come on again?
Yeah, maybe take your hood off. It looks like you're going to murder somebody.
I think this is genuinely quite scary. Home Bargain. My mum bought it me from Home Bargain, £6. I did it.
Yeah, it's pretty unnerving, actually. Okay.
Hold on.
Let me do this. Okay, serious intro. Not really in the correct attire for a formal introduction, but here goes. So, Philip.
Hold on, I haven't come on yet. Hey, it's me again.
I haven't done the introduction.
Oh, I go off and. Sorry.
Philip Goff is a British author and philosopher, working mainly on philosophy of mind and consciousness. He studied for his PhD at the University of Reading, where he was supervised by Galen Strawson. He then did postdoctoral work at the Centre for Consciousness at the Australian National University, and he went on to hold positions at the University of Hertfordshire, King's College London, the Central European University, and the University of Birmingham. And he is currently Professor of Philosophy at Durham University. Now, he's best known, as I'm sure you all know, for defending a panpsychist or cosmopsychist view of consciousness, according to which consciousness is a fundamental and pervasive property of the universe. And he's done a huge amount to promote that position and establish it as a legitimate philosophical position, which is taken increasingly seriously. He has written a huge number of articles, more than I can count, and 3 books. Consciousness and Fundamental Reality, Galileo, which I think was 2017, Galileo's Era, which I think was 2019, and it's in his new book, Why? The Purpose of the Universe. So no one can say this isn't a guy who doesn't tackle the big topics. Philip, welcome to Mind Chat.
Welcome on there. Hey! Great. I never thought you'd invite me on. Finally! Bloody hell.
Philip always wanted to have you on, but I was a bit reluctant.
Thanks, Keith. That was a lovely intro. I never knew you cared. It's a lovely thing. You're always slagging me off and bullying me on the show.
Well, let me say a bit more, actually. We'll get into some discussion. And there's a lot in this book claims in this book that I disagree with. But I want to say, first of all, that it is a fantastic book. And I really urge everyone to go out and get it and read it. I disagree with Phil about a lot of things, but he's a fantastic philosopher. He's a very, very good philosopher, believe me. He knows how to do philosophy. And he also knows how to write philosophy for a wide audience, how to write it accessibly. And this book is one that I think your layperson could pick up and read and understand the core of the argument. There are also some bits that are more technical, that are more for the people who are a bit deeper into the subject, but they're clearly marked. So this book is one you can anyone really can pick up and read this. And I guarantee you that you'll be intrigued, fascinated, and perhaps challenged by it. If you agree with its arguments, then you'll have powerful, if you agree with its conclusions, you'll learn some powerful arguments for defending them. If you don't agree with them, as I don't, you'll face a stimulating intellectual exercise because you'll have to think to yourself, well, how am I going to reply to that? Because you know, this isn't just airy-fairy speculation. This is serious philosophy based on serious data and serious argumentation. And it covers a huge range of stuff. I mean, the title, The Purpose of the Universe. What's the point of living? Why science points to purpose? Why consciousness points to purpose? Why the omni-God probably doesn't exist? Anti-theistic section there, which would actually be quite congenial, I think, to many atheists. Cosmic purpose without God. A conscious universe, living without purpose. And then as a bonus, a little bit on taxation and why it's a good thing. And why it would help us to have a fairer and better society. It's a shortish book. You can read it in a day or so. And I urge everyone to go and do so. So, and that was my bit of sincerity here. Now I'll get into teasing Philip again.
Thanks, Keith. That was really, I thought you'd say shit. That's really lovely. Thank you.
Oh, come on. We
paid him to say some of that, actually.
We tease each other, but you know I love you, Philip, despite the pineapple. I haven't forgotten about that.
I was going to swindle you with the Patreon stuff. I was going to, you know, lie about how much. I might rethink that now.
You should read this book because it tells you why you shouldn't do things like that.
Right. There you go. Well, no, I believe in objective morality, but I don't actually practice it. That's just for the little people. Right, yeah. Whereas you don't believe in objective morality, but you're one of the most moral people I know. So I'd sell out. I'd sell my mother for a few more snow. I'm going to go a bit too far.
Come on, let's get into it. Look, yeah. I just said some nice things about.
I want to ask another question. Actually, where did you get that zombie poem from?
Ah, I thought of writing one. I wanted a zombie who wanted to be a zombie who wanted to do Shakespeare, and so I thought, I'll try and do a bit of blank verse. And then I thought, I can't be bothered. So I went to ChatGPT and I asked it to type me a little monologue in the style of Shakespeare, and it just threw that up. And it's not bad. I don't know whether it's heavily influenced by something that already exists, whether it sort of plagiarized something, or but if that was made up out of sort of whole cloth, it was pretty good.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
It is unbelievable. Oh, and since I haven't got a co-host this week, here's my co-host.
Is that?
Oh, and I should have had this as well.
A horrible thing.
I don't know. It's something I found. And this is just my snack if I get hungry. In the
you always have extra things. I've just got this, actually, this crime scene. I'm actually in my sister's house in the bedroom, my teenage niece, because I'm away from home, and they already had this crime scene Halloween accessory. So you always have loads of, you always go the extra mile, lots more effort. I need little accessories and stuff. It's lovely.
Come on, let's get into this book, because I said it's fascinating. So you tell me about it. Give me the big idea of the book. So as I understand it, that what you're trying to do here is you are trying to have a picture that sees the universe as having, as you say, a purpose, but so it's not traditional atheism, which sees the universe as just a meaningless and brute fact, that it's just there and there's no sort of meaning to it. But it's not traditional theism, where the universe is designed by a benevolent omnipotent God, is it? It's something in between. So give me the...
So I guess, so many people think you have to fit into this dichotomy of, do you believe in the God of traditional Western religion, or are you a secular atheist where it's just a meaningless, purposeless universe? So is it, which side are you on? Whose side are you on, Richard Dawkins or the Pope? Come on, make your mind up. And I guess I've just slowly come to think that actually both of these worldviews are inadequate. Both of them have things they can't explain about reality. So in terms of theism, it's the familiar problem of reconciling a loving God with the terrible, gratuitous suffering we find in the universe, in the world. Sound familiar problem. Hope I give something of my own take on that. In terms of the typical secular atheist, meaningless, purposeless universe, I think struggles to explain the fine-tuning of physics for life, which I'm sure we'll get onto, and also certain facts about the evolution of consciousness, which I think are difficult to make sense of from that worldview. So I try to press in the book, I guess, both the typical secular atheist position and omni-god theism, have things they can't explain, and then explore the much neglected middle ground. So ultimately I'm arguing, yeah, that there is some kind of purpose or goal-directedness at the fundamental level of reality, teleology, if you like, from the Greek telos, some directionality, but in the absence of the traditional God. And I explore a range of hypotheses for trying to make sense of this, make sense of goal-directedness, cosmic purpose in the absence of the traditional God. And most of the book is just building the cold-blooded philosophical and scientific case for this position. But then the final chapter is exploring the implications for human meaning and purpose, thinking about spiritual practice, spiritual communities, political struggle, and thinking of the implications for human existence. So yeah, that's it really. As you say, my first book was an academic book. My second book was aimed at general audience. This one is trying to do both. So each chapter has a more accessible bit and then a digging deeper bit that goes into more of the detail. So probably it's going to please nobody, but anyway, we'll see how it goes. It means it's reasonably priced, actually.
That's a nice feature of the book, I think, that you can get the core message without getting into all the technical details, but the technical details are there for people who want them. I think that's a nice way of doing it. Okay, so one of the key things here is the argument from fine-tuning, which you think is an argument for purpose in the universe, which has been relatively neglected. It's a version of the old-fashioned argument from design, isn't it? That there are features of the universe that point to its having some sort of intelligent or purposive origin, rather than just being a cosmic fluke. So do you want to just outline that, and then we can talk a bit about it?
Yeah, I thought you'd want to talk about this. Just before I do, actually, we will have some Q&A at the end. So hang on in there. Don't put up questions yet because I'll lose grip of them. But yeah, towards the end of this time, we'll do some Q&A. Yeah, so this is the, I think, surprising discovery of recent physics that for life to be possible, certain numbers in physics had to fall in a quite narrow range, or at least this is how it seems with our best current theories. Obviously, the evidence could change tomorrow. You can only work with what you currently have. So perhaps the example that's most startled physicists revolves around dark energy, the force that powers the accelerating expansion of the universe. So once you do the calculations, it becomes apparent that if that force had been a little bit, to oversimplify a little bit, if that force had been a little bit stronger, everything would have shot apart so quickly that no two particles would have ever met. We wouldn't have had stars, planets, any kind of structural complexity, and therefore no life. Whereas if that force had been a little bit weaker, it would not have counteracted gravity. Everything would have collapsed in the first split second after the Big Bang. Again, no life, no stars, no planets, no structural complexity. So for life to be possible, it seems the strength of this force had to fall in, had to, like Goldilocks porridge, be just right, you know, not too strong, not too weak. So that's the phenomenon. It's fairly uncontroversial, I think. You know, there are disagreements around certain cases. That's just one case. There are lots of, seemingly lots of different cases. as you say, Keith, some people have used this to argue for God. God must have fiddled the numbers. I think that's an explanation, but I don't think it's a great explanation, because that runs us into the problem of evil and suffering. I mean, I think fundamentally the way I see it is, so what I'm thinking I'm trying to do in this book is, you know, what is the minimal hypothesis this supports? And we can, you know, I get into the Bayesian details. I hope this is one of the, I hope this is like perhaps the most accessible introduction to Bayesian reasoning, as we're in the digging deep a bit of the chapter on fine tuning. But before I get to the Bayesian way of framing it, the more simple way I like to put it is just with a sort of dilemma. Either the it's just an incredible, unbelievable fluke that the numbers in our physics happen to be right for life, and that seems to me too improbable to take seriously, or the numbers in our physics are as they are because they are the right numbers for life. In other words, that there is some kind of goal-directedness towards life at the fundamental level at the in the early stages of the universe. And there's various ways of making sense of that, but that's what I think is the sort of minimal hypothesis that's supported here. So that's the basic idea. Go on, why do you think it's wrong, buddy?
Well, I want to press you a little bit on whether we need an explanation of this, but let's do something else first, because I think one of the standard responses to this is multiverse hypothesis. I know you have some interesting things to say about this. So what's often objected is, well, look, suppose there wasn't just our universe; there was a multitude of universes, perhaps every possible universe there could be, with every different permutation of the fundamental constants. Then they're bound to be one of those that had the constants needed for life, and the creatures in that universe might be quite amazed that they were, you know, they just happened to be living in this wonderful universe that was adapted for life, and they might think that needed an explanation, but it didn't, because it just happened they were just lucky enough to be the winners, the ones who were in the good universe. Indeed, they couldn't have been in any other. And there is some theoretical motivation for positing multiple universes anyway. So why doesn't that disarm? Why isn't that just as good or even better explanation than the fine tuning, than the purposive one?
Yeah. Okay. Just before I answer that, one thing I forgot to say, and I'll say it now before people think, oh, his arguments are really shit, I'm going to stop watching this video. It is published. My publishers will get annoyed at me if I don't say 9th of November it's published, which if you're watching this live is a little bit in the future, but you can pre-order now in the show notes. But yeah, anyway. So yes, no. Well, I used to go for the multiverse objection for a long, long time. I've always thought the fine tuning needed explaining. I've never been in the camp that says, oh, it doesn't need explaining, but we can obviously argue about that. But I thought, well, the multiverse seemed the more plausible hypothesis for a long, long time. And I was happy, you know, I don't want to be talking about cosmic purpose. I feel really silly, but I've been sort of dragged kicking and screaming to this position. But yeah, I was just persuaded over a long period of time, partly teaching philosophy of religion, actually, when I got to Durham 5 years ago and going through these arguments in a bit more detail. I was persuaded that by philosophers of probability, that there is some dodgy reasoning going on here, in the inference from fine-tuning to a multiverse. So the charge is it commits the inverse gambler's fallacy. Okay, so a lot of technicalities in this argument, but just to make it vivid with an analogy. So suppose Keith, you and I go to the casino tonight, dressed in our wonderful outfits, and we walk in, and the first person we see is just one person in the first room, playing roulette and winning time after time after time, just having incredible run of luck, just winning every time against improbable odds. And I say, wow, Keith, the casino must be full tonight. You say, what are you talking about? We've just seen this one guy. What's that got to do with other rooms in the casino? And I say, well, if there's a lot, you know, let's say there are trillions of people playing in a casino tonight, then it's not so improbable that someone's going to have an incredible run of luck. And that's what we've just observed. Someone's had an incredible run of luck. Now, everyone agrees that's a fallacy. That's the inverse gambler's fallacy, sort of the backwards version of the simple gambler's fallacy. Because our observational evidence is just this one guy or gal having won so successfully, and no matter how many people there are or aren't elsewhere in a casino, it has no bearing on how likely it is that this particular person is going to play well. But I want to say that's indiscernible from the reasoning of the multiverse theorist. You think, oh my God, the right numbers came up in our universe for life against incredible odds. There must be loads of other universes out there with really crap numbers. But again, our observational evidence is just this universe is fine-tuned, and no matter how many other universes are out there, it has no bearing on how likely it is that this universe is fine-tuned, which is our evidence. So that's the basic thought.
I mean, that seems right. The coin tosses, what is the guy doing? He's gambling. What is he doing? Tossing coins or
playing roulette?
Playing roulette. Okay. So yeah, where the ball ends in his roulette wheel is not at all influenced by where it lands in any other roulette wheels around there. It's just as likely that it will. That it will come up if an incredibly unlikely number had just come up at another table, it's no more or less likely that it will come up at this table. And similarly, I guess with universes, each universe is as regards to probabilities is independent of the others. But still, there's a nagging thought here that still there's another factor here, which is the anthropic aspect of this, that there's only one universe we can observe, and that's the one we're living in, and that has to be one that's kind of already won, that has already been tuned for life. So it's not that we've sort of wandered into the analogy is not that we've wandered into a casino and just randomly picked a guy and found that he wins, but that we've been alerted beforehand to the one who's won. Now, doesn't that make a difference? I'm not sure whether it does. It's just tricky to think about this, but my thought, I suggest this to you before, is that if you had a huge number of people gambling in one room, and you had just one person gambling in another room, and you in a third room, and you didn't know what was happening in the other rooms, but a little bell rang to tell you when somebody had an unusually a remarkable stroke of luck. Say I don't know enough about gambling. Say they'd won 10 times in a row. Then wouldn't you think it was more likely that the winner was from the big group than from the small group?
Yeah. So. I mean, there are two ways you can run with this, and then I'll come to your try and work out what to think about your alternative analogy here. Maybe just to talk a little bit about the theoretical underpinnings of this. So I think basically we know what is going on here with this fallacy, and it's a matter of a very important principle in probabilistic reasoning, known as the what's it called now? Gosh, mine's gone black. Total evidence requirement, or requirement of total evidence. Some people, depends whether you want to have a nice acronym. Okay, this is the principle that you should always use the most, you're obliged epistemically to always use the most specific evidence you have, the most determinate evidence you have. And we can define what that means more precisely, but just give an example to make the intuition, an example from Paul Draper. So suppose Keith is accused of murder, and
again,
the prosecution says to the jury, well, Keith always carries a knife around with him. And what they neglect to tell the jury, which they full well know, is that actually Keith always carries a butter knife around with him to try to. You're going down, mate. They didn't lie to the jury. He does carry a knife around with him, but they misled by not giving the most specific evidence they have, the strongest evidence they have, in logical sense of strength, that the most, let me just say, the most specific evidence they have, namely that it's a butter knife he carries around with him. So this is the, this is a very important principle, and this is really what the multiverse theorist is infringing, because we have two ways of construing the evidence here. We could construe the evidence is as our universe is fine-tuned, or we could construe the evidence as this universe is fine-tuned. Well, the more specific evidence we have is that this universe is fine-tuned. So that's the evidence we're obliged to work with. And the multiverse hypothesis does not make it any more likely that this universe is fine-tuned. Just to make that is, I think, pretty clearly what's going on in the casino case, right? You're working with the evidence that someone in the casino played well, had a good run of luck, but that's not the most specific evidence you have. Your specific evidence is this person. So, and this is the total requirement evidence, the principle of the total evidence requirement, that you need to work with the most specific evidence you have. So that's what's going on. And so whilst it is, of course, true, the anthropic principle that if, you know, if the universe wasn't fine-tuned, we wouldn't be around to see it, but it's just irrelevant to what's going on here in terms of infringing this principle. And okay, that's a bit abstract theoretical, but you know, we can get round, we can make that clear just by building a sort of artificial selection effect into the analogy. So suppose, as you and I, Keith, we walk into the casino, maybe there's a sniper waiting hidden at the back of the first room we go into, and they're carefully watching, and if the first person we see doesn't have an incredible run of luck, they'll blow our brain. Oh God, getting a bit overexcited. They'll blow our brains out before we get a chance to observe anything. Well, then we've got a selection effect, right? We've got an anthropic principle of a sense that unless there was someone having an incredible run of luck, we wouldn't have observed them. Just as unless the numbers were fine-tuned for life, we wouldn't have been around to observe anything. So I just think it's just totally irrelevant to what's going on here, and you can see that by building this artificial selection effect into the example. So just finally, your interesting example. Yeah, so it certainly would in that case be true, obviously, that it'd be more likely that you know if the bells rang, you know that someone's tossed well. Someone's had a good run of luck tossing. And it's more likely there. It's childish. Anyway, this should be obvious by now from how we're dressed. I've got no dignity. I think I will be happy in my old age, you know, because I've got no dignity anyway. So I think I'll be, it'll help me when I'm getting aged that I don't have any.
No, it definitely helps.
Yeah. Anyway, coming back to the, yeah, so then it's obviously going to be more likely that the person who's tossed well is going to be in the room with lots of people. But you see, I think that's a completely different... I don't think that's relevantly similar, because in this case, your evidence that the bell rang is logically separable from the particular person who's tossed well, if I may say. Whereas... in the real world case, our most determinate evidence that this universe is fine-tuned is not logically separable from the particular universe that is fine-tuned. Yeah, so I would just say it's disanalogous.
I find this incredibly hard to think about. I mean, I agree with you about the application of the inverse gambler's fallacy to the standard presentation of the multiverse argument. I think you're right about that, dead right. I still can't get out of my head that there's some... that the anthropic principle is interfering somehow, but I find it's a very hard thing to think about for some reason. It's quite it seems to evoke intuitions that may be unreliable. This is one of the interesting things about the book, because that chapter gives a very nice presentation of this issue, and however you want to go on it, it's challenging. Certainly, if you're not happy with the idea that the fine tuning of the constants provides evidence for value selection, for selection of a universe for its value, the purpose if force, if you like, at work in the creation of the universe, then you've got to do some serious thinking to deal with this chapter. So anyone who's who doesn't like that conclusion, urge you to read this chapter and get some thinking done, because it's hard.
It is a bit of a mindfuck, and I was back and forward with this for ages. Can I just say one thing autobiographically, actually? I talk about this in a footnote, but I used to go back and forth on whether this total evidence requirement, I thought it must have counterexamples, because I thought, you know, there do seem to be cases where you don't use the most specific evidence you have. Like, for example, think about evolution.
Right.
You know, our evidence for evolution isn't, you know, you might think, isn't like, oh, Billy the monkey evolved, you know, or Keith evolved, or, you know, these particular animals. You'd think it's more general, it's more generic, you know, some complicated organism. So I was thinking that must be a counterexample for a long time, and I was going back and forth on this. But then I discovered quite an old paper by Draper and others from 2007, where actually, and we're not going to be able to talk about this now, but he just goes into the probability calculus, and you can separate out the weak evidence from the strong evidence, and they're just not counterexamples to this principle. And that was the point. I was just like, fuck, oh my god, there's cosmic purpose. That was the point, where it was just like, the multiverse is just so, yeah. So as you say, if you go in with these analogies, it's like, oh, how do you think about this? How do disagreeable me and I on disagreeable me on Twitter? We've been going back and forth these analogies. But to me, what sells it is, well, it's not about analogies ultimately. It's about this principle, this very simple principle that you're always obliged to use the most specific evidence you've got, which is incredibly important in probabilistic reasoning. I don't think it has any counterexamples that we know of. So it's that really that made me think, oh my god, the universe has a purpose, which is
My intuition, but it's nothing more than that, is that our total evidence also includes some kind of perspectival facts about our epistemic situation relative to this setup, and that introduces some disanalogy with the casino case. But I can't articulate that, and I'm not even convinced.
And I remain open-minded on this, as always. I'd love to be persuaded out of this. I'd love to be, you know, I thought it was embarrassing defending panpsychism.
I'm not sure I believe that. But anyway, let's try a couple of other thoughts about this. One is that, let's say that the value, what you call the value selection hypothesis, the hypothesis that you and the universe was somehow, what to say, intentionally, that it was tuned because it was good for it to have those values, the values that support life. Somehow the fact that it would become life-supporting played some role in shaping its origin. I think that's roughly the values. Okay, but there are lots and lots of other hypotheses that would explain it. I mean, perhaps it's that no other combination of constants is stable. A universe with any other combination of constants would have just sort of couldn't have maintained itself. I mean, I don't think there's any reason to think that in current physics, but who knows, we might find something like that. So there might be the stability hypothesis. Or it might be that the universe was fine-tuned for all kinds of reasons. Why particularly to support life? Maybe it was fine-tuned to support great big galaxies, the big colossal structures which somehow have value in themselves. Or maybe it was tuned by some sort of evil malign entity to support suffering and disease and death, because of course where you have life you have death, and arguably the amount of suffering in the world is greater than the amount of happiness. I don't know. Maybe it was tuned for the final end of all this, which is going to be the relentless dissolution of everything that's ever been created, the relentless the growth of entropy till all that's left is an undifferentiated soup of energy that has no. And it was the dissolution of it all that was the purpose. I mean, I can just keep on coming up with, if we're just plucking hypotheses out of the air and saying, what is more probable than a complete cosmic fluke? Well, then any number of things are more plausible than a complete cosmic fluke, I suppose. So how do you get to this specific one that it was, isn't that, again, doesn't that look a bit parochial? Like, well, yeah, life's important to us here on this little planet where there's a lot of it. But from the cosmic perspective, is life that important in the big picture of the universe?
Good, yeah. I mean, well, some of those views I'm open to, you know, I consider, so as you know, I'm not arguing for the omni-god because I think there's the evil and suffering issue. So I do consider the evil god hypothesis, evil designer or amoral designer, or the simulation hypothesis that we're in a computer simulation and there's some random software engineer in the next universe up. So I do consider like a range of hypotheses for...
I wouldn't have got it past the ethics committee.
Yeah, I think the evil designer just faces the mirror image, as Stephen Law has nicely argued, the mirror image of the good design hypothesis, because then you got the problem of the good. Why did evil God make all the nice things? But anyway, I think sometimes improbable things need explaining, sometimes they don't. And I think it depends on whether there's significance to the outcome independently of it being the outcome. So, you know, if you've got like a random number generator and it just spits out, you know, some totally bizarre, you know, random seeming number, 7921067, whatever, that's incredibly improbable that it would be exactly that number, but it doesn't need explaining because there's no sort of significance to that number independently of it's just that the number that happened to come up. Yeah. Whereas if before, a decade before the generator came up with that number, that, you know, there's been this long-term cult who worship that particular number, you know, and moreover, they predicted that the generator was going to come out with that number on this specific date. Well, now that has significance, because independently of just what came out, and you can make sense of this in Bayesian terms with, you know, it lowers the prior probability and so on. But yeah, so I suppose ultimately I think that what is striking about the fine tuning is that of all the values, that all the numbers that might have come up, the numbers that came up allow for a universe with things of great value, life, intelligent life, people who can fall in love and write poetry and contemplate their own existence and get ChatGPT to write them a zombie Shakespeare poem and so on. Whereas most of the other numbers, insofar as we've explored the possibility space, there's little or no value. You know, most of them is kind of, a lot of them is just like a universe of hydrogen, the simplest element, not much value, or, you know, the universe collapses back on itself, or so that's what's striking and needs explaining, that of all the numbers that came up, it's the ones that allow for great value. Now that doesn't mean there's a, you know, a great god or anything. You know, it could be that, well, there was this we're in the simulation hypothesis and the person wanted creatures of value to see how they suffer in various circumstances, like when Trump becomes president or whatever. You know, it doesn't mean, but it means there's, we need, it would be too much of a coincidence if, and we can make sense of this more carefully in Bayesian terms, if the universe, the numbers just happen to be right for something of great value.
What this brings out is your value objectivism, that you think there are features of this universe that are objectively valuable and that are absent in, would be absent in other universes with different constants. And I guess if you think that, then it looks pretty plausible. But again, isn't that a bit anthropocentric? Yes, biological life looks pretty important to us on this little planet here where there's a lot of it. But, you know, from the perspective of the universe as a whole, is that important? And I mean, okay, a hydrogen-filled universe. Well, I suppose from our carbon-based perspective, that doesn't look very interesting. But I mean, maybe it's a beautiful, elegant, simple, wonderful, pure, undifferentiated universe, which is what ours is going to end up as being if we write that inflation will continue that the universe will continue expanding, not inflation, will continue expanding until whatever maximum entropy is reached or whatever. So, I mean, I suppose from one perspective, our universe might look horribly messy and the life might be, I mean, what was it? Didn't Nietzsche describe life as a disease, on the surface of the earth or something like this?
He wasn't very well, but anyway.
Well, yes, but I'm sure there are perspectives from which this might not look like a tremendously valuable universe. To us, it looks valuable because, you know, we're here deeply involved in its intricacies, and we've got all these, I guess, biologically programmed goals that are, you know, things that we want to survive and reproduce and so on and so on. There's all this striving that we have, and that looks important to us. But aren't we just projecting that onto a bigger scale and saying that the universe becomes more objectively valuable when there's that kind of stuff in it? Sure, we can create value, we can value things, we can choose to value things. But the idea that the universe is itself intrinsically valuable because we're in it, does look a bit anthropocentric, doesn't it?
So yeah, I used to think actually that, and I know you've expressed this before, Keith, that you had to believe in value objectivity to get this argument going, because otherwise there's nothing special about the life and intelligent life. It's just what we happen to be interested in or whatever. But I now think, and I think this is Tim Mulgan has that view actually in his very interesting book, Purpose in the Universe, where he argues for what he calls anthropic purposivism, which is the view that there is anthropic purposivism.
What's purposivism?
He argues that there is, so I'm arguing for cosmic purposivism, like purpose filled, and he's arguing for anthropic means, yeah, and sort of again, uninterested in humanity. So he thinks there is a purpose in the universe, but it's nothing to do with us. We're a sort of accidental byproduct on the way to something better. So that's his way of, it's a similar project really, of accounting for both fine-tuning and other considerations that normally people think point to God, but also the terrible evil and suffering. So that's where it's an fascinating book. Also by Oxford University Press. I've forgotten my train of thought now. But so I used to think that, but I'm now thinking, I think this is one of the, if I may say, original points of the book, that I think, and what I now think is you can build the value objectivism into the hypothesis that is being supported by fine tuning. So I take the, what is the hypothesis being supported is A, that life is objectively valuable, and people contemplating the existence and so on, and the fact that life is objectively valuable somehow played a role in determining those constants. Mm-hmm. There's a sort of conjunction, a kind of conjunctive hypothesis. And then the fine-tuning, once you're assuming both of those, the fine-tuning, these numbers as opposed to others, becomes more probable. So actually you get sort of empirical support for value objectivity, which I thought.
But can't you do that for any other object of value that you locate, that you look at, like, you know, having big planets or something, and do exactly the same conjunction for that hypothesis?
Good point. So you might think that the hypothesis that hydrogen is of intrinsic value, or someone made an objection to fine-tuning arguments, you know, that tungsten is the most important thing because the universe is also fine-tuned for tungsten.
Nice tungsten, it's really nice.
But I guess because most of it's just any kind of structural complexity. But yes, good point, Keith. I expect no less from you, of course, but that's a very good point. And this is something I have in a footnote somewhere. Basically, where I ended up with this is, yeah, I think you have to have a higher probability, a higher credence, what we call prior probability, you know, the probability you assign to it before you bring in the evidence, a higher prior credence for life being of objective value than hydrogen being of objective value, right? Yeah. So, but you could still have a very low credence. You could. Suppose you work in metaethics and you have like 1%. You think it's 1% possible that value objectivity, roughly as most philosophers who believe in that think of it, is true. And I think you ought to, because, you know, it's a very high percentage of philosophers who believe in value objectivity and think, you know, life is objectively valuable and so on. But you just have 1% credence, suppose you're 99%, you know, nihilism or subjectivism or whatever. But your credence that hydrogen is objectively valuable is like 0.00009 or something. I think that would be then enough, because the probabilities we're talking about fine tuning are so more than astronomical that that would boost up your 1% to like, you know, 99%.
But as with all Bayesian inferences, it all depends on your priors. And if you think that the idea of, if you see the notion of purpose as something that really does emerge from, you only really get purposes when you get something like evolution and you get biological organisms that have, you know, you get teleology from biology, as effectively, you know, that, when you get replicating systems that have interests and define themselves in separation from the rest of the world and so on. Well, if you look at it like that, then then any sort of attribution of teleology to the universe, you're going to have very, very low prior for that.
But yeah, but you'd have to, but the probabilities are so immense here. What, like a conservative estimate is sort of 1 in 10 to the 136 or something. You know, you'd have to have a really ridiculously, in my view, a really, really ridiculously low prior. Whereas,
well, no, you could, your hypothesis could be just that any other combination of constants is unstable. Just doesn't work. I mean, you don't need to appeal to teleology at all to explain why they are as they are. There's all kinds of hypotheses. If we're just doing likelihoods, you can pluck things out of the air.
But I mean, the thing is that with Bayesian reason, it's the relevant kind of possibility and probability here is epistemic. So we've got to work with the evidence as we have it, and
right, but
the evidence as we have it doesn't suggest, you know, whatever, you'd need these constants for something else other than value. And so I think that would be cheating. I think that would be to give more of a probability, a weighting to that would be kind of cheating, I think.
Look, we don't have any evidence. Let's suppose that there's some hidden constant that somehow imposes constraints on all the others and can only be, and it means that they can only take the values they do. And that this is a yet to be discovered feature of physics that limits the constants to that range. Yeah. So it's the undiscovered constant hypothesis. Okay. That's no more extravagant than the undiscovered purpose hypothesis. We've no idea where this purpose came from. There's no other evidence for it apart from fine-tuning, because we can do all the biological stuff easily enough by evolution. So you've got this, you've just sort of plucked some purposive force or something. It's just a hypothesis that you've just come up with no independent evidence to explain this curious feature. I come up with this unknown constant hypothesis to explain it. Why is mine, and given my priors, maybe that I think purpose is always tied to biological systems, then mine seems better.
The unknown purpose of the gaps.
Well, yeah, very good.
I don't think the evidence supports that. I think that, you know, I think the evidence, the evidence we have suggests that the numbers are right for life, and that's quite improbable compared to them. I don't think the evidence suggests that there is some unknown purpose or something. So,
constraints can be.
It's a possibility, right? So there's a possibility that, yeah, there's something else that gives us these constants. But then there's another unknown cause that would give you slightly different constants, and another unknown cause that would give you slightly different constants. And yeah, so this lowers the probability, so each of these hypotheses, because you'd have to divide your probability space among unknown constant that produces exactly our constants, our values of the constants, unknown constant that produces, you'd have to divide up. So the hypothesis that there's an unknown cause that delivers the constants we actually have ends up having a ludicrously low prior probability because of
why is ludicrously low probability to the idea that we might someday discover some constraint, some fun that falls out of physical theory that has the consequence that the constants must lie in that narrow range?
Because and this is something I go into as well, you know, when you do Bayesian reasoning, you know, as I'm sure you know, Keith, just with the audience, you know, you subtract out the evidence you're considering and you ask, you know, how likely is the evidence on this hypothesis? How likely is it on this hypothesis? How likely is it on this hypothesis? The hypothesis you're asking us to consider So we're pretending we don't know the values of the constants. The hypothesis you're asking us to consider is there is some unknown cause that ensures the constants are fine-tuned. Well, that's a possibility, but so is an unknown cause that gives you slightly different constants and an unknown cause that gives you slightly different constants for all the possible ranges of the constants. And then you ought to divide up your probability space equally. So yeah, so it's going to end up having an absolutely...
But our evidence includes the fact that the constants in the only universe we've ever observed are like this. So it doesn't that alter the fact... We're going to get into some deep stuff here. And maybe we should try and... But this is one of the reasons why this stuff is really, really interesting, because it is mind-bendingly difficult to think about, but kind of pretty important, I guess. One final question on this, because I want to move on and get some other things, but why do we need to explain this anyway? I mean, I think I was reading some notes by Hugh Miller, which is just that, look, I mean, and you say this at many points in the book, but, you know, explanation's got to stop somewhere, okay? So we explore, you know, we do science, we try and understand the phenomena we find around us, and eventually we come to some fundamental facts about the world, you know, fundamental physical facts, facts about the kind of things that you mentioned at the beginning that reflected in the these fundamental constants. Well, that's how it is. That's how the universe is. Why is it like that? Well, that assumes that there's kind of a bigger picture which we can tell an explanatory story about the fundamental facts. But if they really are fundamental, well, that means we stop there. And we say, but just that, that's it. There's no wider context in which there could be, which we could offer an explanation for something that is fundamental. That's what it means for it to be fundamental. So the only task is, I mean, we may, before we started investigating, we might have, you know, and if people had speculated about what they were going to be, they might have said, well, it's very unlikely they'll be very, very precise like that. But we investigated, it turned out they were. That's just how the world is.
Good. So I totally agree you have to stop somewhere. And, you know, I'm happy with stopping. One of the options I consider is just stopping with a teleological law, a law that directs the universe towards life or value or something.
But that is an explanation for an explanation. What we're taking from them. It's not taking them as fundamental. They're fundamental.
I appreciate that's not what you're saying. Well, I just think the fine tuning in a standard base, you know, the great thing that the advantage we have is that we have Bayes' theorem. We don't just have to appeal to intuitions. We have Bayes' theorem that tells us how evidence works. And I think in a standard application of Bayes' theorem, it looks pretty straightforward in my view. Obviously, it's debatable to an extent, that the fine-tuning supports goal-directedness towards life or value. So if we just stopped, we'd be ignoring that huge bit of evidence. So
that's assuming the question is a legitimate one. How do we explain the constants? You're framing hypotheses about it and testing their likelihood, but testing the evidence for them. But what if that question isn't legitimate?
So I think these framing the issue in the idiom of explanation, does this need explanation, is fine in certain contexts, but I think ultimately it's a superficial level of analysis, and ultimately we should come to just a Bayesian understanding of what the evidence supports. And I
what you're using Bayesian reasoning for is to assess different hypotheses, different explanatory hypotheses. We're still in the game of assessing explanatory hypotheses. Yeah. The fact that we're using Bayesian reasoning to do it is kind of neither. If someone says it doesn't need an explanation, period. So assessing the different hypotheses, you know, in a Bayesian fashion is, you know, moot.
Yeah. So, but the evidence of fine tuning does support cosmic purpose hypotheses over chance. It does, in a standard Bayesian analysis, unless there's something wrong with the reasoning, it does support, and we can't ignore that evidence.
Bayesian reasoning is certainly a powerful framework, and you apply it beautifully enough. No quarrels about that. But of course, it's only taking you from one set of priors to posteriors. It doesn't tell you what's true. It just tells you how to keep your beliefs.
If you want to give cosmic purpose a ludicrously low credence, then yes, you know. But I think that I would suggest that would be sort of ad hoc and the definition of bias, in a sense. I suppose I also in the background think Oh, I made an alteration at the very last minute because Paul Draper actually has an excellent book coming out defending atheism. The world's greatest atheist, Paul Draper, not Richard Dawkins. And it gets very, he asked me, employed me with a grant he has to make comments on it and gets really into probabilistic reasoning. And he has a kind of objective Bayesianism where prior probability corresponds to the sort of simplicity of the hypothesis. Actually, he runs it slightly different. But so I suppose I think, you know, really prior intrinsic probability of a hypothesis should just correspond to its simplicity. I think cosmic purpose is like weird, not what we're used to, but it's not like a really complicated hypothesis or something. So I don't know, I'd
argue about that actually. But anyway, I want to have time to talk about some of the rest of the book. So let me
you're
just
showing great discipline, Keith. You're a better presenter without me. You're showing great discipline in moving us on. It's good.
Let me just say that if you're in, you know, this chapter 2 of this book, fantastic on this, and also will give you a good introduction to Bayesian inference, Bayesian probability theory, and it will enable you to start thinking about these things and start torturing yourself with these arguments.
He's so kind, Keith. I have to show I am not paying him to say these things. But
are you? You said
that was part of the act. That was part of the act. You've ruined it now. Shit. You always ruin it, don't you? Anyway, let me think of it.
Okay, let's move on. Let's look. Okay, so but that's only part of the story about
do we want to do the consciousness stuff as well? Because I'm thinking
I think we should say a bit about it and about, because one thing that the book does, and this is for the people who are interested in the Philip's views about consciousness and the mind, this, you know, I mean, you've outlined these in papers, but it's a nice introduction to the latest developments in Philip's thinking about consciousness and the two particular.
Just to say, I think we've got 30 minutes left, so we
We've got a lot to do.
Have like 10 minutes if you want to talk about them. 10 minutes, well, 10 minutes, 10 minutes for Q&A.
Let's talk a bit about. There's two things. There's strong emergence, which is one thing you've moved on to, which I think is. I'm very worried about. But anyway, what about panagentialism? That you want to combine panpsychism with panagentialism. So it's not just that these fundamental particles are conscious, but they're also little agents. Now, I think you said this, that some of your fellow panpsychists thought this was the moment you jumped the shark. but I'm, you know, go for it, Philip. But actually, you think that actually, I think it's the solution to a particular problem. That your sort of conscious realism and the other panpsychist form of conscious realism faces a very deep problem that they're not actually property dualist forms, but phenomenal realists face a particular problem. You think panagentialism is the fits it like a key in a lock or hand in a glove. So just tell us a bit about that.
Good. This is the most challenging bit of the book, I think, that comes with a warning. So I think there's a big problem underexplored making sense of the fact that consciousness evolved. And I do think consciousness evolved, to be clear, but I think it's a challenge to make sense of that because natural selection just cares about survival and hence just cares really about behavior. It's only behavior that matters for survival. I'm writing something for Scientific American that should be coming out around publication day on this. People are interested. Given the recent rapid progress in AI and robotics, I think it's become clear that you can have incredibly complex information processing and behavior without any kind of inner life or experience whatsoever. And so it seems conceivable that natural selection could have created survival mechanisms, you know, very complicated mechanisms that mechanically track features of the environment, initiate very survival conducive behavior without having any kind of inner life at all. So for any kind of behavior that's associated with consciousness that's good for survival, it seems you could have had a non-conscious mechanism that does the same stuff. So why does natural selection create consciousness at all? I think there's a big puzzle here. And I think you have to take some quite radical steps to make sense of this. So yeah, so the idea is this panagentialist view that rational agency goes right, not just consciousness, but rational agency goes right down to the fundamental level, that particles have some very, very simple kind of rational agency. Again, it sounds crazy, but they're not doing, not rational agency in the sense that human beings have it. They're not, you know, deliberating and doing probabilistic reasoning like we've been doing and doing math or maths, as we say, because it is plural. The idea is basically they have certain very, very crude desires or inclinations, and they can respond rationally, they're disposed to respond rationally to those inclinations by pursuing the object of desire. So I think that is a rational response. Now, if you're a mature human being and you feel like doing something, you can deliberate about it. You think, is it a good idea? Do I really want to eat this chocolate? Do I really want to lash out at this person? But the idea is particles are so simple and they don't have any conscious understanding. They can't deliberate. The only rational response that's available to them is the most simple rational response. Do what you feel like doing. And so that's why we get a predictable world at the level of fundamental physics.
The universal wave function.
But sounds all nuts. But why take this seriously? Because I think once you've got that in place, all you need is natural selection. Because natural selection now has a motivation to give us conscious understanding of the world around us, because we're going to respond rationally to it. We're going to survive well. So I do think consciousness evolved, but you need something like that in place, I argue, in order to make sense of the fact that consciousness evolved. So that's the idea. Sounds nuts, but consciousness is hard data and we need to account for it.
This is what I like about your work, because you take phenomenal realism seriously, and you take seriously the fact that if you separate feel from function, if you conceptually separate how an experience feels from what effects it has, if you make a conceptual separation there, you're not a functionalist of any kind, then you have it. Then you've created a problem for yourself here. And yeah, you've got to address it. Well, okay, go for it. I mean, to me, given my priors or whatever, it seems like a very good reason for doing a modus tollens and not making the separation in the first case. But, you know, at least you're facing up to the problems of your own, of the phenomenal realist position. And I respect that. I mean, to me, I confess, I kind of think, yeah, go for it, Philip, because all of this makes phenomenal realism seem more extravagant and outlandish. And so I can say, look, that's where you've got to go if you want to do it. But yeah, you do it.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, we can completely eye to eye on this, Keith.
Yeah, I know. It's the odd thing.
Funny the way we meet on something. So yeah, this is only a problem that arises if you think there's a conceptual gap between consciousness and behavior.
Yeah, you de-psychologize consciousness.
Your view totally avoids that. I give you that. And you could see this as an argument for your view. That's absolutely fine. But just to be clear, just so people don't misunderstand, it's not a view you avoid just by being a physicalist, right? The most popular form of physicalism by the Phil Papers survey is what sometimes Chalmers calls type B physicalism, strategy, where there is a conceptual distinction between consciousness and behavior, not a metaphysical distinction. They think zombies are conceivable but not possible. They're sort of logically coherent, but that's enough to get the argument going. Standardly with the hard problem stuff, you have this tussle about whether you can infer from conceivability to possibility. You don't need to do that with this argument to pose a problem for the physicalist, because the relevant kind of modality, the relevant kind of possibility in Bayesian reasoning is epistemic. So it's only the conceivability that matters. So it's only the conceptual distinction that most physicalists accept. That 60% of philosophers who answer the consciousness question think there is this conceptual distinction. I know not many people are discussing this problem, but I do think it is a huge problem for standard physicalists that they're not even at first base thinking about, I think.
Of course, the one line here is that people are I've got an incoherent concept, I kind of think they have. But anyway, just fit that into the bigger picture. How does this then support the purpose of the picture of the purposiveness of the universe?
Good. Well, in two ways. Firstly, I think that just is a kind of purposeful universe. So the idea is that matter is rational stuff. All physical entities have experience and respond rationally to the character of their experience. So that is purposive behavior. It's not purposive in the sense of, you know, a designer outside the universe has put it in, but in the sense in which, something like the sense in which Aristotle believed organisms and everything has sort of dole directedness. You know, he thought fire goes up because it's getting to its place in the heavens, earth goes down. Obviously, that's all bullshit. But so I think you can have purpose, teleology, purposeful stuff without, you know, there being a designer. But also, I think there's an intriguing interaction between the fine-tuning and panagentialism. So just for the sake of argument, suppose we now believe in this, we're in a universe of rational matter. You need both to get conscious organisms with understanding. You need both the fine-tuning and rational matter. So if you just had fine-tuning and no rational matter, then maybe you'd evolve kind of zombies or something. I talk about meaning zombies in the book, but anyway, let's not go into that. But you wouldn't get conscious understanding. Or if you just had rational matter without fine-tuning, you'd have the potential for conscious understanding, but it would never be realized because you'd never get the right kind of structural complexity. So you need both working together. They fit together like a lock and a key. And I suggest that's sort of, again, too coincidental to be taken as just a coincidence. So I think that bolsters the case for the fine-tuning case for cosmic purpose, the fact that they fit so well together.
So it's fine-tuning for non-zombie life. It's fine-tuning for conscious life, really, rather than just for life per se.
Yeah, I mean, I think so, because I guess I don't think there's much or any value without conscious in zombie life, which is one of my PhD students, Eli Takashima, is working on whether zombies, my friend Jeff Lee believes in equal right for zombies. Well, we've had, anyway, but yeah, I guess I think there's not much value.
And you, and so you think that purposiveness then is actually fundamental to, you know, it's another fundamental feature of the universe and pervades the universe.
So yeah, I consider a range of hypotheses. The most straightforward way of trying to deal with this is to just tweak the definition of God. So maybe it's a bad God. Maybe it's a simulation hypothesis. Maybe it's a God of limited abilities who's made the best universe she can. You know, and she's like, I know it's going to be messy. I wish I could do better, but it's this or nothing. But so that's the first hypothesis to consider, non-standard designer. But it's not obvious you do need a conscious mind to undergird cosmic purpose. Thomas Nagel has worked out a very detailed account of teleological laws with purposes built into them. So there might just be a fundamental directedness towards value at the fundamental level that interacts with the known laws of physics in ways we don't fully understand. The third possibility connects with my previous work, cosmopsychism, that the universe itself is a conscious mind with its own goals. And I try to argue that's not as extravagant as you might think and probably just about the best hypothesis, but I take all three seriously. So yeah, that's the idea, really.
So the idea then is that the universe as a whole is, it's not, well, it's conscious and it has a purpose and it's trying to shape itself within the constraints imposed by the physics to produce things of value such as, but it's already produced things of value. So I mean, it is itself a thing of value, isn't it? I mean, so it's trying to produce higher forms of value then, because I guess if it's conscious, it's already valuable. And it's trying to shape itself to promote to produce things of even greater value. Is that right?
So the laws of physics on this view come out as the constraints on what the conscious universe is able to do. So it's not that something outside the universe is constraining it, it's just that's primitive fact about what it is and isn't able to do. And I have it's a sort of research program that mirrors the multiverse theorist, actually, whereas the multiverse theorist is trying to expunge fine-tuning from the laws that govern the whole multiverse. I'm trying to expunge fine-tuning from the constraints that limit the conscious universe. And Richard Swinburne reviewed my book for Times Literary Supplement, which, and when that's come out, we've had a debate on the Unbelievable YouTube channel, which will come out, and he's kind of pushed me in interesting ways in this. But anyway, I sort of just take what the multiverse theorist says and give it a different ontological interpretation. But yeah, I suppose, yeah, is the universe, conscious universe, greater than us? Is it less great? In some sense, it's more powerful, I suppose, but I suppose you might think of it as having a certain rigidity, that it's just sort of got all these options and just sort of mechanically going for the most valuable one, whereas evolved conscious life has more sort of flexibility and the capacity to deliberate and choose. And so, yeah, so maybe there are some ways in which we are superior. Even Swinburne thinks there's some ways in which we're superior to God, in that he thinks we have free will and God doesn't have free will because God always does the good thing. So not superior to God, maybe. Maybe, you know, he's going to tell me off. But there are certain goods available to us that aren't available to God, for Swinburne.
Right. So let's just get this clear. So on the panpsychist view, the fundamental forms of consciousness, it's very, very simple. And the fundamental forms of agency are very, very simple. So all the little particles want to do is to do what the wave function tells them to do, more or less. I think that's right. I hope that's not too far caricatured. Now, on the cosmos psychist view, and then the panpsychist view, all the larger scale forms of consciousness are assembled from those micro consciousnesses in some way. On the cosmos psychist view, it's the universe as a whole that is conscious and that has agency, and other sort of human sized minds and are elements, selections from that universal consciousness and that universal agency, I guess. So now, tell me a bit about the consciousness of the cosmos. What's it like? I mean, is it massively richer than ours? You'd think, I guess it would be on that, if it's as much above us as the consciousness of the particles is below us. And what's its agency like? Is all it can do, is it just able to tune the constants and that's about it?
Yeah, so I guess the picture is that it's, if you want to fit the meaning of life in, by the way, we better move on in a minute, just to say. But
we can do the meaning of life in 5 minutes. It's
So there have to be. So I try to suggest it's a really actually very parsimonious hypothesis, because I think, as I've argued in previous work, I won't go into this now, but I think physics just gives us mathematics. There must be something that underlies the mathematical structures of physics. There must be something that underlies the regularities we perceive in nature. This is Hume's point, that we just see regularities, we don't perceive directly what underlies them. So the hypothesis that it's a conscious mind pursuing value under certain constraints, I want to say, is fits with observation, is no less parsimonious than any other proposal. The one thing you have to add is that you have to give it sort of knowledge of the future and somewhat, not knowledge of the, not
yes, seeing. I did notice that bit, that about the value, because it's got to know what the end product of its tuning will be.
So, you know, 13 billion years ago, it sort of decided these constants because it knew life would come about. So I basically say what you have to add is it's the universe just, it's a primitive fact that it knows the future consequences of any choice available to it. So it's just got all these choices. It knows instantly all the choices and just selects.
That's a big one to swallow.
Now, you might say, Keith, you just have said it, but that makes it so extravagant. Now, here I cheekily borrow from the multiverse theorists and say, I think they say quite plausibly, because when people say, oh, it's so extravagant to have all these universes, they say, no, well, what determines parsimony is the principles that govern your theory, the axioms, and the basic axiom that the universe represents all possible consequences of its actions is a pretty simple axiom. It generates all these huge numbers of representations, just like the laws of the multiverse generate all these multiverses. But that doesn't matter. It's the causal principles, the generative principles that matter.
Always, it's all about your priors, isn't it?
no, it's about simplicity.
People to
yes. So if people want to,
we'll talk about the meaning of life while they're doing it.
Put Q and ask a question. So put Q if you want to now ask a question. Q and then your question. And then while they're gathering, Keith and I can decide what the meaning of life is.
So you've painted us this picture of a purposive universe, a universe that is has a telos, has an end, it's a goal of creating richer forms of conscious understanding, conscious experience. Okay, so how? Okay, let's say I've bought all that.
Have you? Brilliant. Well,
let's say I have. This is a hypothetical. What's the moral of that for me, for the way I live my life, for the way I think about what's important and what I should be doing with my time, with my limited time here?
Good. So I'd say most of the book is just the cold-blooded case, and my colleague David Fratchie, we talk about fine-tuning, he's saying, okay, maybe you've got a case for that, but I don't care, you know, it doesn't, I make my own meaning or whatever. And so you could, you could think it has no implications, that you could accept most of the book and then think, I don't care about this. Yeah. So I sort of defend a middle way. It's always about the middle ways to me. One extreme.
You're a liberal Democrat.
What?
You're a liberal Democrat, metaphysical liberal Lib Dem.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, you don't like that one.
Heaven forbid. Lost some train of thought now. So one extreme, you got someone like William Lane Craig, Christian philosopher, thinks, you know, if there's no purpose to the universe, it's all pointless. He even says we might as well kill ourselves or kill each other, do what the hell we want. I also talk about the antinatalist philosopher David Benatar, who thinks something similar. The other extreme, you got my colleague David Fratchie, the familiar humanist position of cosmic purpose would just be irrelevant to the meaning of our lives. Whether it exists or not. So I take a middle way position that I think we can have perfectly meaningful lives. I'm not an objectivist about these things. I don't think it's just up to us what is meaningful, but I think if we pursue things that are objectively meaningful, like love, pursuit of knowledge, understanding, creativity, you can have a very meaningful life. I was quite happy before I believed in cosmic purpose. But if you... I don't know whether I do believe in cosmic purpose. I think it's more probable than not on the current evidence. But anyway, but I think if there is cosmic purpose, then there's perhaps the hope that we can have more meaningful lives. You know, I think we want our lives to make a difference. If you can, in some small way, contribute to the purposes of the whole of reality, then I think that's huge. That's about as big a difference as you can imagine making. So I try to talk about, and I have come to think that this cosmic purposivism can, living in hope of cosmic purpose, seeing what you're doing, connecting up to that, can be a deeply meaningful way of living life. I've found it to be quite meaningful. Keeps my ego in check, keeps me friends with you, Keith. So I suppose I'm just, you know, I'm not laying the law down saying this is the only meaningful way to live life, but there's a possible way of finding meaning that's not the more familiar religious one, not the more familiar secular atheist one, that people might think, maybe I could go for that.
Yeah. I don't find it as congenial, I think, as you do. I mean, the picture you paint of what a meaningful life is in the last chapter, I mean, I agree with it, yeah. But I don't think it needs to be underwritten in this way by an objective set of values and an objective purposes in the universe. Even if there were, as you say, even if there were such things, we could choose to ignore them and do what we want. I mean, we make our own. We know living's a creative act. You decide what kind of person you want to be and try and be that person. And it's more expressive, I think, as I see it. And you know, I don't mean to be this sounds uncharitable, but I don't mean it like this. But it's almost like this picture of the universe having this grand scheme. It's a bit like sort of a cosmic Boy Scouts that we're supposed to sort of join up and, you know, do our best to, you know, I kind of think, you know, sort of F off, you know, I'll just make my, I don't like the idea of the universe kind of telling me what I should do. I mean, I think, oh, yeah, if I want to be good and nice, I'll do that because that's what I want to be. Not because the universe wants to recruit me to its grand project. But that's facetious and superficial. Yeah. And as I said, I do like the picture. I mean, one of the things I did mention about, there's lots of interesting not exactly asides, but you talk, for instance, about the value of organized religion separately from its as an institute, as a not exactly an institute, as a community. Distinct from as a set of beliefs and dogmas, and you talk about the value of of belonging to a religious community and social community. And that was lovely. I agree with all of that, really. And of course, there's a bit about taxation at the end, which I also agreed with. So there's loads of interesting asides in this book. And I think I agree with the spirit of it, but I just don't see the metaphysical underpinning as being necessary or desirable. That which isn't to say that it's not true. I mean, it may be that we live in a cosmic Boy Scouts group.
Yeah. Oh, Keith, you always do this to the guests. Say, actually, we think the same things, and you've done it with me. Actually, I remember it actually when we were on the boat when we first met. We were on the boat with Daniel Dennett and others in 2014, and I remember talking about religious fictionalism with Dennett actually, and I was a bit scared. I thought he'd shout at me, but yeah, he was somewhat sympathetic actually.
This is why when I talk about illusions, I don't think of illusions as bad things. I think myths we live in a world of, if you like, fiction, a world of projects and plans and loves and dreams and hopes and things. And that's what's magical about our lives. We're not pinned down to seeking the daily reality. I mean, sadly, some people are, but the great the wonder of life is that we can live in a world of if you like fantasy and illusion. That's wonderful. That's what all literature is, and it's amazing. That's the great place to live. And so, you know, in saying that I think of, in a sense, of phenomenal consciousness as an illusion, I don't think it was a bad thing. I think it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful world to live in this, as Nick Humphrey talks about, this sort of magical enchantment that natural selection has a sense of enchantment that natural selection has equipped us with to enrich our lives and make our engagement with the world deep. I love all this stuff.
So you're a fantasist. That's what you're saying, really. I'm joking. Don't answer that.
I don't think it needs to be woven into the fabric of reality to be meaningful. That's what I say. Yeah. I mean, I think we create meaning.
You reminded me another incident on the boat when I gave my talk and I was quite passionate, and Nick Humphrey was also on the boat. We shared a cabin all week. He said, well, you're proving my point at how passionate the illusion of consciousness makes people. I mean, it's important to point out, this has been a little bit of a misunderstanding. I've done quite a lot of interviews on this now. You know, going to come out all when publication, you know, I'm not saying value is grounded in cosmic purpose. I think that would get you in the Euthyphro dilemma that you have with trying to ground value in God's commands. You know, okay, so God commands us not to murder. The Euthyphro dilemma is, did God do that because murder's bad? Or is murder bad because God commands it? And either way, if it's the former, then the badness of murder is independent of God. If it's the latter, then God could have commanded us to murder, and that would have been good. That seems to make morality rather arbitrary. I think you'd have the same if you tried to ground value in cosmic purpose. If there is a bad purpose, and to some extent there might be, you know, the simulation hypothesis might be true, and to some extent, this is about, I agree with William James, that it can be rational to an extent to hope beyond the evidence. To the extent that I'm assuming it's a good purpose and we can contribute to it and it's not over yet, this is all to an extent hoping beyond the evidence. But so it's not like I'm, that the cosmic purpose is setting the score. It's more like, we in the universe are in a common project that is good. And that, wow, it's this huge project. That's exciting, rather than just this little smaller project.
To questions. Do you want to look at select the questions yourself, or
I'll just go through them in order.
You can put them up on the screen, can't you? There.
Yeah. So we haven't got as long as. Unfortunately, I've got quite strict time limits today, but we'll try and answer as many.
20 minutes.
Mark O'Brien, disagree with me on Twitter. How would you respond to your one axiom is very complex because it relies on high level concepts, not simple mathematical concepts? Aren't you just giving simple labels to complex ideas? This is a really good objection that Mark should write a paper on, that we've debated in the pub quite a bit. So the idea is, well, value concepts. I mean, it's something you could launch against Swinburne as well, because he argues that God is very, very simple. But to the extent that both of us are appealing to objective morality, you might think objective morality is very vague and nebulous. And it's a good question. What do I think about this? I've forgotten that. I mean, I suppose I'm not sure it is so vague, really. I think, you know, that it might have quite simple axioms that, I don't know. Well, I'm quite sympathetic to what's called the objective list theory, that, you know, there are some... I'm not a simple hedonistic utilitarian that, you know, pleasure's the only good. I think there are goods like understanding, knowledge, and so on. But it could be there's a quite small number of them. And that's it. You know, they're good. Okay, but anyway, I'm sure that argument will go on. Let's try and get through some of these. MPG. Doesn't panagentialism have a combination problem too? Good question. Yeah, well, look, I think really the combination problem, I'll speak quickly because I'm running out of time, sorry. The combination problem really arises if you're trying to go for a really reductionist panpsychist view. Now, I don't think you can run this as a reductionist view, because it's the idea that I think to make sense of the evolution of consciousness, I think we have to dump that kind of reductionism. We have to think, when conscious understanding and the capacity to I think the capacity to rationally respond to it is always there, but when conscious understanding emerges and creatures are rationally responding to it, that makes a radical behavioral difference. Things behave in a more survival conducive way than you would do just by the basic laws of physics, or it's at least easier to get to survival conducive behavior. So that's why consciousness evolves. So basically, you just have to have a sort of primitivist view where particles have basic combinatorial capacities to combine in certain ways. And once you've given up on reductionism anyway, I think that's fine. Considering free energy principle as a foundation for panagentialism. Oh God, who was saying this to me recently? Lots of people who was I talking to about this recently? Oh, I think Lee Cronin. This thing I've got coming out with Scientific American about strong emergence. And so I talked to Lee Cronin, who has his assembly theory, and Kevin Mitchell, who's strong emergentist neuroscientist. And maybe, I don't know. I mean, so yeah, this is a general framework which could be combined with empirical specifics in lots of different ways. That's an interesting thing to think about. Very good question mark, O'Brien. That's not a question. Okay, let's go to the next question. Try and get through as many of these as possible. How do you feel about using temporal language? This is Jonathan's question, to refer to consciousness. I believe qualia are present and that agency becomes complex as capacities like memory and causation develop. I mean, some people have tried to object that Susan Schneider objects to panpsychism on the grounds that it's not clear that time exists at the fundamental level of reality. And so the fundamental stuff will be atemporal consciousness, which he thinks doesn't make sense. Excellent paper by Barry Dainton called The Silence of Physics, where he thinks about the consciousness of a photon, because photons, you know, don't experience time. I agree. I'm open to the possibility at least that fundamental consciousness isn't temporal, and that these things emerge with memory and so on. Human panpsychism is fundamentally Copernican, and you can have radically different consciousness at the fundamental level, can be radically different to human consciousness. And on X, the constants of nature come down to our measurements experiments in the end, don't they? Why is it a mystery that the constants pick out the world we observe? That's the point to begin with. Why is it a mystery that the constant? Yeah, I mean, we observe the constants, but still, it's a fact, I believe. I'm an objectivist about truth. I think it's a fact that those constants are as they are, and that needs explaining. Or if you want to put it more carefully in Bayesian terms, that supports the value selection hypothesis I'm putting forth. Well, that's the last with a Q next to it. Wow, we got through all the questions. Well, there's actually one without a Q. Final one from Jack Eastling. How does your theory compare with Spinoza's pantheism and necessitarianism? It seems to undercut the need for fine-tuning to be explained and is more simple than your view and Swinburne. Yes, well, Spinoza's fascinating and an influence on me in lots of ways. I don't go for the necessitarianism. David Boulos, very good panpsychist philosopher, who's an assistant professor at Princeton, is a monist necessitarian in the Spinozist tradition, perhaps, although for very different reasons, perhaps. Well, I don't think it would explain fine-tuning for the reason that we touched on, that the relevant kind of possibility in Bayesian reasoning is epistemic. So yeah, everything could be necessary, but it wouldn't get rid of the fine-tuning, because still epistemically think the values could have been different. And you can see that because, like, you know, suppose, I don't know, for every day, you know, the words of the Bible appeared very clearly in the clouds, like really, really clearly in order every day for like a year, you know, from in the beginning. I think we'd all take that to be evidence for God. Any rational person, you know, if it was really undeniable, or that someone's tricking us or something. But you couldn't say.
I wouldn't. I mean, it's in what language would they be written?
Okay, Greek. Greek for the New Testament, and, well, I don't know, ancient Hebrew for the... Anyway, well, let's not get into that, but I would say, like, you still wouldn't say, oh, well, I'm a Spinozist, everything exists necessarily, so that removes the evidence. I think, I mean, well, it would remove any kind of explanations if you just say, oh, everything's necessary, but I still think, you know, anything, you think about detective work, or you still... You know, I don't know, let's take a less controversial case. You know, the DNA evidence seems to point to Joan being the murderer. But you could say, well, no, this is just necessitarianism. Everything, you had to have that evidence. I think you'd see that it doesn't universally destroy Bayesian reasoning. And the reason is that Bayesian reasoning works on epistemic modality. Anyway, we better kind of leave it there. Thanks so much, Keith, for taking the time. I'll have to reciprocate.
You want just T-Board's question there? How about constructive? Do you have a chance to follow Jack's question?
Oh, okay. Final question. I'm going to have to dash. How, T-Board, Koos, how about constructive theory? What is constructive theory? Do you know what constructive theory is, Keith?
I thought you might know.
It rings a bell, actually. Constructive theory. Is that like maybe similar to assembly theory? Is that the precursor of assembly theory? Yeah, I mean, you could combine that with assembly theory, but I still think, I mean, I think the minimal thesis this is pointing towards is value playing some kind of role, because it's improbable that it's just coincidence that the numbers that come up are compatible with the universe of value. So if you combine some kind of something like constructive view, I don't know if that could bring in that value pointing element. That would perhaps be fine. And obviously, like, I'm not a scientist. The details of this would be the question of empirical work. It's just a very general framework. All right. Okay. Thanks so much, Keith, for doing this. Are you going out trick-or-treating tonight?
Every night's trick-or-treat. not specifically, the kids maybe. It's a pleasure. It's great to have you as a guest.
Bring out your little friend again.
I was going to say this was going to be my co-host.
Really horrible.
You see, this is going to be my co, and he was going to ask questions, but he stayed silent.
Let's spin it. Do you, because I interrupted you before because I thought you were having a nervous break. Do your zombie thing again, because you put a lot of time into learning that and getting it ready. Go on. Do you want
to? I didn't learn. I have to find it again. I'll read the first bit of it. Remember, this is a zombie who dreams, a zombie with aspirations and hopes, all in a functional sense. And he wants to be a Shakespearean actor. And so he says, oh, wretched fate that hath befallen.